From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for you. We are grateful for your support and hope you continue it. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Happy New Year, every one of you. I hope 2016 will be filled with peace, joy, and the kind of coming together that our world is crying out for. This month, we are proud and not a little surprised to find ourselves celebrating 10 years of bringing State of Belief Radio to you. As we wrap up the holiday season, we'll look back at a couple of particularly noteworthy interviews that are part of that 10-year history. From 2008, you'll hear a conversation with the late Reverend Forrest Church on why the dialogue between religion and politics is not much different today than it was over 200 years ago in this country. And we'll replay a conversation with Samir Selmanovic about his book, It's Really All About God, Reflections of a Muslim Atheist Jewish Christian. But first, it's been a crazy year in religion news. At least crazy. You may have other words for it. Topics that we cover weekly with little mainstream media attention have suddenly broken into the spotlight and onto the front pages. One thing we've done for years on this show is to take a look, an intense look, at the most important stories, noisy or not, in religion news of the past year. We've done that with the help of Religion News Service. And I'm really happy to be able to welcome Jerome Sokolowski, Editor-in-Chief at Religion News Service, back to State of Belief Radio for our year-end religion news review. Jerome, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It's my pleasure, Welton. Good to be here again.
If you were to pick the top three religion news stories or themes of 2015, what would those be?
Well, I was afraid you were going to ask that, Welton, because it's such a hard question to answer, and there are different ways of looking at these stories as well. So if you would say what were the most covered stories this year, I would definitely say the Pope's visit or the lead-up to the Pope's visit was definitely one of the most covered. And then, unfortunately, the violence we had in the name of religion or involving religious individuals. The shootings in San Bernardino, in Paris, in Chapel Hill, even, in a way. Yeah. The other way of looking at stories is what are the stories that will be the most consequential or that were the most consequential? And there I would put in the Charlie Hebdo shooting, actually, which brought back this debate about that began back with the fatwa against Salman Rushdie. And with the Muhammad cartoons and the Jyllands-Posten newspaper in Denmark, as to what extent do religious freedom and freedom of expression coincide or exclude one another, and to what extent do we allow people's religious sensibilities to be offended, whether they are Muslim or Christians, and we've had cases of artwork that has offended Catholics and other Christians as well. Let's see. Also on my most consequential list is the Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage. That was definitely a biggie. And also RFRA laws, the religious freedom laws, in which people are making a case that there should be exceptions or conscientious objector status for implementing or abiding by the gay marriage laws.
Several of these probably are going to be pretty high on the list of the major news stories of the year, and I would consider that a good thing, that religion news is right there at the top on what's on everybody's mind anyway. Would that be a fair thing to say?
Yes, sometimes it's hard to distinguish, and I struggle with this every day here at RNS, as to what is a religion story.
Uh-huh.
Are terrorist attacks always religion stories? I think not. I think often they're really, it falls under the realm of politics.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, sometimes there is a clear-cut religious aspect to them. Another big religion story is the Charleston shooting, and mm-hmm. also, and how African-American Christians have been subjected to racism or attack, and just sort of their being on the receiving end of a lot of hatred, very unfortunately, that it's not just been in this attack, but also there were a string of fires at black churches, and also the expectation in a way that somehow when members of the AME church in Charleston forgave the shooter, Dylan Roof, somehow that made many people feel better about it, almost as though there's an expectation of that as opposed to an anger over it, which gets into the whole Black Lives Matter movement, which I don't consider to be a religion story, although religious individuals have been very involved. Clergy has been very involved in that story. So mm-hmm. that kind of pushes its way into the list as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you added those. Let me go to your most covered list and ask you, are there one or two stories from this past year that you would consider underreported?
Unfortunately, undercovered stories for me tend to be abroad. I feel like we pay too little attention to stories that are happening abroad. I think in the mainstream press, one undercovered story, but it's getting better, is the persecution of Christians in the Middle East. And in, I guess the really undercovered one is the situation of Christians in China. It's complicated there. There are restrictions on the building of churches. There have even been demolitions of churches. It's a complex story there, but certainly it deserves attention. And in the Middle East, we've seen horrific things happen to Christian and other minority communities there. And like I said, some of it, there is more mainstream press attention to it than we've seen in the past. But it's still something that is so shocking that we could get more attention. Another undercovered story is the situation of Jews in Europe. There's been an exodus from France of Jews there. Some of the terrorist attacks we've seen have also targeted Jewish communities there. And I guess also undercovered has been the response in support of Jewish communities. I don't know if undercovered, but perhaps one of the more hopeful stories is the what they called the Ring of Peace, where there were Muslims and Jews forming a kind of cordon around synagogues in Oslo and Stockholm, and I believe in some other places after some of those attacks, to preserve their right to worship there.
You know, I think, and I almost knew that you would turn to some international stories, and I'm so glad you did. It's almost as if in the news cycle in many religious circles, we are on an island. We're being isolated from the rest of the world at the same time that we are so caught up in the rest of the world in reality, but we're not really dealing with it very intelligently sometimes. And one that strikes me, because you mentioned it early on in Undercovered, the persecution factor and the dramatic difference between what religious persecution means in most of the foreign stories and what religious persecution means as defined primarily by the religious right in the United States.
Yeah, it's a very good point and good question, Welton. I think part of it is that we are navel gazers here in America, and we're very focused on the Kardashians and all the popular culture here, and that's something that you find in other countries as well. So we're not paying attention so much, as much as we should perhaps, to what's going on beyond our borders. But there's also an element of we're not used to seeing Christians as victims, either here or in other places. There are many Christians, especially on the right, who will talk about victimization and who now feel that secular culture is pushing them to the margins of our society. But certainly when you talk about religious freedom overseas, it's hard for many people in general to conceptualize this idea of Christians being under attack. But we really do see in some of these countries in the Middle East that despite their history of authoritarian rule, they have had different religious communities living there. I wouldn't say it's been ideal. It's been far from harmonious. But they have been there, and that's really coming to an end in a big way in some countries like Iraq and Syria, and it's even being threatened in a big way in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the relationship between mainstream media and religion news service and reporting on religious news. Curious at 2 points. How do you think mainstream media are doing in reporting about religion? And coupled with that, is there a particular topic that you think was maybe even misrepresented by mainstream media this last year?
Well, I do think mainstream media has gotten better at reporting on religion over the years. But having said that, many newspapers and news outlets are dropping dedicated religion correspondence, and that's showing. I suppose it's good for us at RNS in a way, in that more people will come to us for that kind of news about religion reported by a secular outlet, non-denominational, non-partisan outlet. But the coverage generally has gotten better. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a story where there could have been a more... I mean, let me put it this way. At RNS, we always try to find a religious dimension of many of the top stories often have a religious dimension, and I think that's where we come in. So I would almost say that every story, really, the religion angle is undercovered, and that's the opportunity for us to come in and focus on that.
Well, that's a very good insight and a very good point. Do you think our literacy as a society is getting better or getting worse when it comes to identifying the role that religion plays in major events, both at home and abroad? It's exactly what you were just saying.
I don't know. It's a good question. I think among younger folks, it's getting worse. I don't see many, with the rise of the nuns, of the NONES, the people mm-hmm. who don't identify with any religion, there's a lack of religious education. We've never been that great in America at teaching religion, teaching world religions, or teaching what religiosity is, mm-hmm. certainly not in our public schooling system and many of our private schools. I've seen other countries do a much better job at this. And so there's a certain lack of sophistication when it comes to knowledge about other people's faith. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that does come through exposure through media and, I guess, people teaching themselves about other faiths. But there's definitely a lot of ignorance across, despite the fact that we live in such a pluralistic society, there's a lot of ignorance of other people's faith.
Jerome is editor-in-chief You have a broad overview of the coverage RNS provides on a daily basis. That makes me curious. If you were a reporter right now, what story would you be most excited about really digging into?
Well, in the coming year, with the elections happening, I'm really, really interested in seeing how that all plays out. I don't think it's going to be the kind of religion story that we've seen in past elections, where someone's going to have to explain their faith to other people. Mm-hmm. Short of having a Muslim contender for president, I don't think anyone anymore has to justify their own faith background as President Kennedy did or candidate Mitt Romney did. But I think religion will sort of burst its way in, as it did with Donald Trump's proposal to ban Muslims for a while from immigrating to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I think it will play out in other ways, other surprising ways in the coming year. Mm-hmm. I think the other interesting story to look at will be how President Obama talks about his faith in the coming year. I have a hunch, I guess. I don't really have any evidence, but aside from the fact that he's been more comfortable coming out and being public about his faith and in expressing religious concepts, I think one of the most interesting stories of the year, which I didn't mention yet, was his eulogy after the Charleston shootings, how he really responded in an African American Christian way, in a kind of in almost a prayerful way that he gave that eulogy, and I think he might do more of that in the coming year or something like that.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me he is becoming more and more relaxed about talking about whatever he wants to talk about than he was for many years. You've been editor-in-chief at Religion News Service for just a short while. In that time, have there been any surprises or unexpected experiences that you'd be willing to share?
I guess I didn't expect how intense it would be, that there would be so much going on with a religious dimension, so many news developments which require some kind of explanation of what's the religious component of this. Mm-hmm. I think it was the first or second week I was here, we had the attacks in Paris and then San Bernardino and the shooting out in Colorado Springs at the Planned Parenthood clinic. These are all straight stories about political violence, but they're also stories where politics and religion do come together. Mm-hmm. So I've been surprised at how much of that there is. I would love for RNS to be a nice, quiet sort of place where we do beautiful stories about, you know, feature stories, and we do those as well. The intensity has surprised me.
I can understand that. Well, look, this is an easy one because nobody can contradict what you're saying because nobody knows the truth about this.
But
you've already taken a hint, given us a hint on this, but what do you think will be the defining stories and themes in Religion News this coming year? I mean, we know the election is going to be front and center a lot of places, but what else do you see on the horizon as news that's going to make a difference?
One story which is happening now already is how the position of Muslims in this country will play out. There's certainly been a rise of reported hate crimes, and we've actually seen attacks on mosques. And the story of whether we in America will embrace Muslims as equals in a religious sense, that they are like religious and ethnic groups who've come here in the past, from Jews to Irish Catholics to anyone else. I think that will be one story. Is this a surge now that will sort of fade after a while, or will there continue to be a serious problem with hate crime and racism? Mm-hmm. And another story I would like to cover more is immigrant churches. I think I may have said this in our first interview on your mm-hmm. on your show, but I think immigrant faith is fascinating in this country. What happens when people come from other places, set up churches or mosques here, and bring the old country here, and how that helps them adapt to life in America? It's a very different experience from in Europe. I do think the immigrant faith communities do help people find their place here and be part of American society, as opposed to Europe, where sometimes it helps separate or give this feeling of separation. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Jerome Sokolowski is a veteran religion journalist and broadcaster who serves as editor-in-chief at Religion News Service. RNS is an essential resource for anyone concerned with religion's role in our culture, our government, and our world. And in addition to finding the work of their journalists in many leading publications, you can and you should visit religionnews.com on a regular basis. Jerome, this has been a real pleasure, just having a conversation about what has been and trying to peer into the future. We will be talking, I hope, a lot through the next year, but it's very helpful to have your reflections on this past year and to prepare us for what may be coming down the pike. I wish you a happy new year, and I thank you profusely for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Wilton, it's been a pleasure talking to you, as always. Thanks for the invitation to be on your show. Thanks for the pitch for RNS. I do welcome and encourage all your listeners to come visit us, find out about religion in America, what's going on in religion in America and the world. Visit our website at religionnews.com. Subscribe to our Slingshot newsletter. You get headlines of some of the most interesting stories of the day from around the web. And have a great to 2016, start of the new year, Welton and everyone else.
The Reverend Forrest Church was one of my best friends. We talked often with each other. Never did I come away from a conversation with him without learning something really important and also being inspired. I miss him to this day. Reverend Forrest Church was a leading writer, speaker, and theologian who passed away in 2009. A frequent guest on this show, he brought important ideas forward in language that anyone could understand. I remember speaking to him in 2008 about the long and troubled history of religion and politics in this nation, and I want you to hear a part of that conversation. Our next guest not only understands how it started, he argues that it's never really changed. Reverend Forrest Church is a minister of All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Manhattan. He's the author of the new book, So Help Me God, The Founding Fathers and the First Great Battle Over Church and State. Forrest Church also comes from a distinguished line of prominent politicians. His grandfather was a governor, and his father was Frank Church, a six-term Democratic senator from Idaho. Forrest Church is simply one of my best friends from whom I always learn in conversations. I sat down with Forrest in New York to talk about the book and what it means for modern politics. Forrest, welcome to State of Belief.
I'm delighted to be with you. I'm always delighted to be with you.
I want to get right into this book because you've done us a great service in publishing this. You have said that the group that says America was founded as a Christian nation and the group that says we have an explicitly secular foundation are both half right.
They're both 100% half right. That's
now
exactly
explain
right.
that.
Well, the same division we have today existed right at the founding. There are two sources that combine to create the American experiment. One is it comes out of New England. It's the notion of a Christian commonwealth or a commonwealth of God with a strong moral foundation. And the other comes out of the Enlightenment, particularly Enlightenment France, the notion of sacred liberty. So divine order and sacred liberty came right up against one another on this question of church-state separation.
So much of this thought is embodied, or it seems to me is embraced by the phrase which you use and others do so regularly, so help me God. Tell us about that phrase.
Well, that goes into and then comes out of inaugural lore with Washington. It's not certain that he actually said it. I believe he did. There was an argument going on at the time as to whether or not senators and congressmen would swear, so help me God. That was the first bill indicated they would. Finally, they just swore to uphold the Constitution. But the first inaugural was set up by the church party, by an Episcopalian, actually, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia. And there was a worship service identified with the inaugural. I expect that Washington said, so help me God. I know that Jefferson asked the Supreme Court Justice John Marshall explicitly whether or not he had to say anything else other than the congressional oath. Marshall said he did not. From that point on until late in the 19th century, when inaugurations were modeled after the Washington model, there was no so help me God in the oath of office that the president swore.
And when we look at the different perspectives on religion and the presidency, that comes out for most people out of a concern for the relationship between religious institutions and political institutions. The First Amendment obviously has the religious liberty clauses in it. The phrase separation of church and state has become kind of a bad phrase in some people's minds. Where did that come from?
Well,
what's the development?
What's so interesting, the point I make in So Help Me God to tracing the story of the first American culture war. It's interesting that the religious left of the time, the people who wanted to have absolute separation of church and state, very, very severe, the leaders of that movement were the Baptists. It was the Baptists, the Methodists who were more passive. All of the religious outsiders, the Catholics, the Jews, all wanted church-state separation. Why? Because they knew from past experience that whenever God had a seat in government, it wasn't going to be their God. The religious right back then were the Unitarians, the Congregationalists, the Episcopalians. Why? Because they were the elites. They peopled the governments of the states that had established religions, and it was their churches that benefited from the church-state collusion. So that actually continues, that idea of religious outsiders being supportive of church-state separation or independent spheres, if you'd prefer to put it that way, the religious insiders not being as sensitive to the dangers of this kind of collaboration. And it took throughout the entire first 30 years of our history finally to sort this out. It wasn't until after the War of 1812 that church and state were actually separate, and they remained quite separate from that point on until the Civil War.
Now, I know that some of our listeners are still in the process of adjusting their radios because you said that the Baptists
were the hard left
and the Unitarians were the right.
That's exactly right.
Now, how did that flip-flop?
Well, it flip-flopped because today the Baptists are, to a degree, along with the religious right, I would call them, as long as the Republicans are in power anyway, they are the religious insiders. They know that government will have their ear. And so they're not as sensitive to the issue as they were when they were being persecuted, when they had to pay taxes for someone else's churches. But if the Baptists go back to their history, they will find and So Help Me God, the heroes of the book are really the Baptist pastors. I mean, they join with Jefferson and Madison First of all, to disestablish religion in the state religion of Virginia, and then to create a freedom of conscience clause in the Constitution, the First Amendment. It is, by the way, Welton, it's the Baptist pastors of Orange and Culpeper County, Virginia, who forced Madison to do what he didn't want to do, and that is to champion a Bill of Rights and to write a First Amendment, because he was running for Congress in Virginia, and they'd always been allies throughout their many struggles, but Madison was not in favor of amendments. He did not think there should be a Bill of Rights. And it was the Baptist pressure lobbies in Virginia that forced him to commit, should he be elected to Congress, that he would put at the top of his agenda a Bill of Rights and a First Amendment, a Freedom of Conscience Clause. And so they get credit, the Baptists get credit more than any other group for the establishment of the First Amendment, which today sometimes they complain about.
It was a Baptist pastor, as I recall, named James Leland.
John Leland, right.
John Leland,
right.
That knew how to do political lobbying with Madison to see that he got
It was Leland and a number of others who lived in Orange County at the time. Leland pops up everywhere. He's like Zelig in this story. He also participated in disestablishment of religion in Connecticut and in Massachusetts.
Recently, I saw numbers, I think it was from the First Amendment Center, from polling that they had done, in which 60+% of the American people that responded said they considered this a Christian nation. We had Senator McCain, a senior senator,
yes,
recently say that the Constitution established a Christian nation. Can you believe that?
It's important. Everyone seems fascinated by the history of our founding, and I think that's wonderful. But it's important that we go back to that history and read it straight. And I think that's important for people on the right as well as those on the left. For instance, people need to recognize, who are very opposed to any kind of religion in politics, that it was the God Party, if you were, the established church party, that forced the issue of abolition. If the church-state separatists, the Jeffersonians, the sacred libertarians had had their way, the government would never have gotten involved in emancipation because there was no legislating of morality. But to go back to our founding and say that we were founded as a Christian nation is to actually completely subvert the genius of the founders, who do not introduce religion into the Constitution. And every time, Welton, that there's been an attempt to put God or Christ into the Constitution, that attempt has been very easily knocked down. Are we a religious country? And in fact, do we even have a religious government? To a degree, yes, particularly since the Civil War, when In God We Trust went on the coinage and the idea of a national Thanksgiving was established. But the religiosity of the nation goes back always. The reference is the Declaration of Independence. So part of our being a religious nation is that we defend the rights of church-state separation and religious freedom. That is part of our American religiosity. So to say that we're not at all religious is wrong, and to say that we're Christian is wrong. In fact, we're religious in a kind of Jeffersonian Declaration of Independence way.
Are we going to just keep on talking about the Republican Party as the party of God, the religious party, and the Democratic Party otherwise?
It's changing. I thought, when I started writing this book, when I started writing So Help Me God, I thought that we were in danger of creating a religious party and a secular party in this country. I divide this. It would be an unum party and a pluribus party, if you think about e pluribus unum, one nation under God versus with liberty for all. In my opinion, whichever one of those parties won, the nation would lose. What I see happening today is that what always happens, once the pendulum flows too far in the unum direction or in the pluribus direction, there's a natural kind of corrective. The two leading candidates for the Democratic Party, and perhaps even the three, are strong people of faith, very, very comfortable in speaking of their faith, very connected to the church, very much a part of the great American religious mainstream. Some of the leading candidates, at least right now in the polls, the leading candidate for the Republican Party doesn't go to church and has some real problems with his church authorities. Latest polls I've seen, you've probably seen others, but show that the evangelicals are splitting much more evenly among Democrats and Republicans. So I think that danger point of our having a unum party and a pluribus party, a religious party and a secular party, is passing. And it's a good thing, because both of our parties need to be aware on the one hand, of the importance of a moral foundation for American governance, and on the other hand, in the importance of the Liberty Clause and absolute freedom of conscience and freedom of belief.
Forrest, this stuff is in your blood. Anybody that knows you knows that's true. I mean, your dad was a respected governor and United States senator. Your mom was involved in politics. Do you ever personally have trouble reconciling religion and politics in your life?
No, I don't really. You see, I believe that there should be an absolute separation of church and state and that you should not separate religion and politics. Our religious views are our deepest views. They should inform everything else we do. But we need to remember that in this nation, we have a formula that comes out of our Declaration of Independence and Constitution that gives us guidance as to how we can bring our religion to politics. We can bring it as a moral impetus to drive our beliefs and express our beliefs. We cannot use it, however, in any sort of coercive way to bring other people into our fold. And that's why church-state separation needs to be so clearly and distinctly maintained.
Reverend Forrest Church is a minister at All Souls Church in Manhattan. We've been discussing, among other things, his most recent book, So Help Me God, The Founding Fathers and the First Great Battle Over Church and State. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Forrest, and what a thrill it is to talk with you with our audience on State of Belief. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
In 2009, I had the pleasure of interviewing author and activist Samir Selmanovic about his book, It's Really All About God, Reflections of a Muslim Atheist Jewish Christian. Anybody that hears that title has got to be interested in hearing something about the book. So here's a part of that conversation. I'm joined by a man who truly understands the dangers of extremism and the importance of real dialogue between religions and between religious people and non-religious people. Samir Selmanovic is a founder and Christian co-leader of Faith House Manhattan, an interfaith community in New York City. He heads a New York-based Christian community called City Lights, and serves on the Interfaith Relations Committee for the National Council of Churches. Samir Selmanovic also has a fascinating personal history. He was raised in a culturally Muslim family in Croatia. He converted to Christianity as a young soldier in the then Yugoslavian army before immigrating to the United States. And now his own story and those he has collected in his years of interfaith work have inspired and informed a new book. The book is called It's Really All About God, Reflections of a Muslim Atheist Jewish Christian. Samir, thanks for being with us and welcome to State of Belief.
Hi, Welton. Good to be here.
You say in the book very candidly that doubt and uncertainty saved your life, and yet, people who hear your story and learn that you were actually disowned by your Muslim father when you converted to Christianity probably will think that you have to be pretty certain in your beliefs in order to weather a situation like that. But you say the opposite. Why?
At the time when I announced to my family that I'm a Christian, my family half Muslim, I would say, and half atheist. They taught that religion is a pyramid scheme of the ages, and that their son has been swindled into it. They had a good, healthy distance from religion, and I embraced my faith completely. And I had certainty at that time because I had to maintain my identity, and I had to raise walls and know what's in and what's out, what's appropriate, what's not, and practices that I would do. But over years after that, certainty produces a certain kind of anxiety, because in order to be certain, we need to exclude all kinds of data. We need to exclude all kinds of awareness, things that are outside of our purview or of our relationships and our texts. Mm-hmm. So over time, I realized certainty is shrinking my world, and I want to live my faith in the world as it is, in a public square with everybody.
Samir, you say that we are at the end of isolated Christianity, isolated Islam, isolated Judaism, that religion needs to evolve. First of all, is that an observation of what you see, or is that an indication of your hope? And what is the next step in the evolution?
I don't know if I'm conflating what I see and what my hope is. But certainly I see in a generation that is coming, especially in my daughters and their age, they are teens now, the religion that is not worried or doesn't have as a central concern the well-being of non-adherents will not be attractive to a generation and to a population that understands that we live on one planet now that is very endangered. It's like we are in one boat. And none of us can drill under our seat and say, look, this is my business. I can do whatever I want to do because I'm sitting here. That's a very Western individualized view of seeing one's faith and one's spirituality. The whole humanity is supposed to be our ethical community. And religions that will work, I think, will invite strangers, people who are the other, closer, to tell them what they see, to tell them what they need, to tell them how they feel, and to be their teachers. So religions that will work will be constant learners on this planet.
I want to pick up on what you just said there, because it's terribly important, I think. I was trying to think through the question that I ask you about the next step in this evolution, and certainly you are speaking about the primacy of morality, of ethics, of cooperation around those values. Is part of what happens or has to happen for the isolationism to recede a reordering of the importance of doctrine, a reimportance of of belief, so that morality comes to the fore more?
I wouldn't say so.
Okay.
I would need to give a direct answer.
Good.
Because the doctrine is nothing but basically saying what matters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a recounting of the story of one people and of one's religion. So these things can be reinterpreted and reviewed, and different texts from our scriptures surface up. We all choose 10 texts that are most important, but other texts that are talking about interdependence can be equally important or more important. So my belief is that tolerating the other and appreciating the other is just the beginning. It's not enough. It is discovering the need for the other in the center of our religious experience, in the center of our dogma and the doctrine, that will move us forward. It is that we cannot live on this planet without the other, without the stranger, who always brings to us something new and tells us what we cannot say to ourselves and see what we cannot see. That has been throughout the scriptures. There's so many examples when religious people come to their end of the rope, and then the outsider shows up, and this outsider, the other of the neighbor, is connected with the otherness of God.
If the future lies in all religions realizing that, as your title suggests, that it's all about God, that no one true faith has a monopoly on knowing God at the expense of others, where does that leave atheists or non-believers? Because for them, it's not all about God.
Yes. In my book, It's Really All About God, I offered it to endorsement to Greg Epstein, who is a humanist, at a chaplain at Harvard University, and he endorsed it wholeheartedly, although it is, the title says it's all about God.
You'll be interested to know, by the way, Greg is on our show today.
Oh, great. Greg is a friend. Yeah. Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. But go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Yeah, that's fine. So I would say constructed this dialogue between religionists an atheist or anti-religionist, as though we have to be enemies and not sojourners on this earth. I think if without atheists, we would be an echo chamber. It would be God box conversation. Atheists bring, as our brothers and sisters, they're necessary and good. And what would the world be without those who doubt God? And the issue is whether rejecting God is such a big trouble with God, as though God has a wounded ego to whom it is important to acknowledge his existence. I think if somebody does good in this world at the expense of acknowledging the existence of God, I think God is happier than the other way around.
Samir Samolovich is the author of the new book, It's Really All About God, Reflections of a Muslim Atheist Jewish Christian. Samir, fascinating discussion. Thanks so much for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you, Wilton.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you for doing that. We rely on listener support to keep this show on the air. Now, we're at the beginning of a brand new year, and I hope that one of your New Year's resolutions was to consider a tax-deductible contribution to State of Belief and to Interfaith Alliance. In fact, I wish your resolution was one that said, I'll do that pretty regularly through this coming year. If you've heard anything on this week's show that you think would be helpful to friends or acquaintances, I wish you would share it with them. That may just be the spark, the push they need to become a regular listener to this show as well. It's very easy to do all of that on Facebook, Twitter, and stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you'll find extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. You just know, friends, that over the course of this year, an election year, a presidential election year, it's going to get crazy. It's going to be fun. You don't want to miss a show. Until I'm with you next time, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.